are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 6, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Daniel Bessner, professor of international studies at the Scoop Jackson School at the University of Washington. In the light of the launch of the Progressive International in Vermont last week with Bernie Sanders, Yanis Varoufakis, and others, what does a global foreign policy look like? We're going to do a continental tour for a left foreign policy vision from the Caribbean to Europe to Africa to the Middle East with the great Daniel Bessner. Donald Trump not concerned about the deficit because he doesn't think he'll be around for it. I guess that could probably apply to
show me the lie.
Whole lot of things that he's not concerned about.
Extremely boomer mindset.
I'm extremely boomer. Saudi-funded lobbyists paid for 500 rooms at Trump's hotel after the 2016 election. What a surprise there.
It's a great hotel.
It is a great hotel, and I'm sure that... I mean, I guess if people from Saudi were staying in it, that's the one country I could see the actual excuse that they genuinely liked how tacky the decorations are at the Trump's. United States bipartisan group of U.S. senators introduced a resolution saying that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was complicit in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Over 1,000 absentee ballots were possibly destroyed in the North Carolina House race as a major newspaper there calls for a redo. Scott Walker, racing through Republican appointments to state agencies as the Wisconsin coup continues, and Republicans are coup-minded in Michigan as well, attempting to lock in austerity and regressive policies as other efforts, including in Idaho, to fight back against the expansion of Medicaid. When Republicans lose, they mount coups. It's the fascist mindset. VA officials were blocked from condemning white nationalism. And Charlottesville email shows Milo Yiannopoulos Yabba Dabba Dusky off of Patreon after one day. Mark Lamont Hill is another victim of a longstanding imperial attack on black internationalist intellectuals as he loses his CNN job for speaking on Palestinian rights, and the trustees at Temple University target him there as well. Lula da Silva, over 7 months as a political prisoner, pens a letter to the new incoming Mexican president as the Brazilian Supreme Court puts off a release for him indefinitely, even as over 20 other people convicted of much more serious charges in Lava Jato have been released from prison. What a surprise. Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador takes aim at neoliberalism in his opening address. The Saudis are losing their way in Yemen, but new information is being revealed on the death squads and paramilitaries that they are employing there, and trillions of dollars lost at the Pentagon. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Here with mi amigos, Matt and Brendan.
Hola.
How's everybody?
Hey, ¿qué pasa?
I'm good.
Doing well.
Do you guys know any Spanish?
I can survive in a Spanish-speaking country.
That's cool.
But I would not have any meaningful personal growth.
Yeah, I could read things like on a menu, but I couldn't be able to converse.
Yeah.
I took 4 years in high school, and I basically... The problem is, unless you travel to a place where that's the language and you immerse yourself in it, it's not going to...
Right.
Language is just theoretical at that point.
Big regret of mine that I never learned Spanish. And it's a big regret of mine. I'm a bad language student. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it was the pedagogy. Maybe I could blame it on them, but I wasn't good. It's a bummer. Now, something happened that was kind of surprising. Not expect to see this. Dave Rubin is known for, what would we say, a docile interview style.
Obsequious.
Obsequious. And, of course, he's extremely far right. And no matter what his latest spin on what his politics are, he just follows the herd, basically.
The classical liberal term, that game is pretty much over.
Yeah, I think the game is over. And he's a follow the herd guy, and the herd he's hanging out with are extreme far right people. I haven't even gotten to the, I think it's Brigitte Gabriel interview, which supposedly was a absolute train wreck with Dave Rubin. So I was really surprised to see this, and I don't want to overpromise any fireworks here, but Tucker Carlson was on with Dave Rubin, and you're going to see a little bit of a pushback from Dave. Or is it a pushback? Is it a pushback or a really, really funny mistake that we're going to integrate into our longstanding tradition of mocking Dave Rubin for being a profoundly stupid man?
Yeah. So what is Trump then? You've interviewed the guy a bunch of times.
I know him well.
Yeah. What actually, in the scheme of what your book is about and sort of where America's at the moment, is he just the great wrecker that we sort of needed so that this ship of fools wasn't going to sink and take everybody
down?
Well,
he's certainly a wrecker. Look, here's what Trump is not. Trump is not the guy who comes to Washington and transforms the system, because he's not capable of that. He's not interested in that. Washington is a very specific town, okay? So, like, the
very
legislative
specific.
Process is highly
Super
complex.
Specific.
He doesn't understand it, doesn't seek to. He's not going to be the guy who runs on these nine policies and then affects them once elected, gets them through the Congress, gets them through the agencies. He can't. That's not his role. It's very frustrating, actually, if you're from D.C. like me, to watch it. You're like, wow, you know, what a second. Get the energy department under control. Not going to happen. There's 3 million executive branch employees versus Trump, okay?
Yeah.
Trump's role is
that right? That's not right. There's 3 million?
Million. 3 million executive. I think there are 3 million executive branch employees. That may include the military, by the way. It's not quite right. But I'm just saying, like.
All right, look, we're being super petty. But he did actually say it was a question mark. Like, he pushed back, like, no, it can't possibly be true. And you're right. It literally could not possibly be true that there are 3 billion employees of the United States federal government. That would be a literal impossibility, I guess, unless they started subcontracting people like in China.
Why do you think
India.
We owe China so much money?
Yeah.
We're hiring them.
Yeah, it's back paying all of our Chinese federal employees.
We're hiring Chinese people to the EPA by 100,000.
I want to open up a new Department of Energy plant in Genoa, India.
This is why I think Tucker's like, oh, this guy ultimately will never be able to be on my level.
Right.
Like, this is just too dumb.
Tucker's like, he's my new friend. And then he's just like, oh, man. All right, let's play this again, and then we'll explain why we're being so petty about it.
There's 3 million executive branch employees versus Trump, okay?
Yeah.
Trump's role is
that right? That's not right. There's 3 million?
Million. 3 million executive. I think
it's fun being uncharitable to libertarians.
Yeah, and you shouldn't ever be charitable to libertarians. But it's like, okay, so Dave Rubin is, of course, the guy who said that Jesus would be nice to Muslims and is the what did this post office ever do for you guy. Is just a, you know, he's just a dim-witted cynic. And I remember Republicans years ago, they tried to make a huge amount of hay because Barack Obama misspoke one time when he was campaigning. And I think he said that he had been campaigning across like all 54 states. And I don't know, maybe he was being woke and he was trying to actually inject like Guam and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and Washington, D.C. should get statehood status. Or maybe he was just exhausted from campaigning and he misspoke. And this goes back, actually, I think, to 2008. And the Republicans were always like, this is ridiculous. Like, Sarah Palin gets dinged for everything. And everybody ignores that Barack Obama doesn't even know how many states there are in the country. And it was like, well, the reason it didn't take off is because he's a smart guy, obviously, who misspoke once. Whereas Sarah Palin is saying literal, just nonsense every day because she's an idiot. And so we should be more charitable in general including, I think, with way bigger things than misspeaking. I think we need to figure out a way to have a much more empathetic and compassionate society. And I mean that sincerely. And sometimes I even question my own role in not pointing to those qualities more. Now, that being said, Dave Rubin's a Dunsky. And somebody else might have gotten away with a misspeak, but he really is dumb enough and cynical enough to actually probably not be entirely sure that that's a wrong stat.
Look, we're just playing our role in the marketplace of ideas. We have to keep the other side honest, right? This is how this works. So,
Tucker Carlson, $3 billion? Man, I thought gay guys were supposed to be smart. It's true. You're absolutely right, though, because they've got this little buddy thing going on, but there's just those moments where it's like, I mean, I really wonder, like, I don't know if he's had on, like, Steve Pinker, who I do not overvalue Steve Pinker's intellect. There's plenty of problems, major problems in his secular theology, which is really what his work is. But there are people who you just have to, like, acknowledge some just sort of like basic firing power they have. The idea of sitting down with Dave Rubin. It's like, hey, so what was Racine's thing? It was just like, guys, so, well, you're interested in science.
Tuesday night, Racine happened upon Dave Rubin impression where you make him sort of like a South Park.
Kind of a South Park character.
And it really does work well.
Guys, so you're not opposed to, you don't support racism, but you're interested in ideas. Totally works. He could be mouthing like some type of like the sock, like, or some like inanimate object that just pops in to say sort of like bigoted nonsense coded in stupidity. Folks, today's sponsor is Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority are going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. I took photography. I essentially didn't have the finances when I was younger to really pursue it. It's a little bit of a, you know, it takes a little bit of investment in order to do it. And it wasn't what was available to my family at the time, but I loved it. And I look at a site like this, that would be awesome to learn how to take a photography course. Also a video editing course. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you in both your personal and professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages. We were just talking about that. Maybe I'll cop Skillshare and see if I can finally, you know, get a little bit of Spanish. New languages, Photoshop, you name it. I've been checking, and I will about to check out their language and photography courses. Those are the ones that I'm going to seek out. I've looked at it a little bit, and I can tell you it looks incredibly user-friendly and easy. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majority. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for a whole 2 months. Again, that's skl.sh/majority. And we've put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to be right back with Daniel Bessner. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectuals. Check out our conversation on it in our Majority Report archives. He's a professor, Pyle Professor of American Foreign Policy at the Scoop Jackson School at the University of Washington and a regular contributor on The Michael Brooks Show, part of our core crew. Daniel Bessner, how you doing? Thanks for being here.
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me.
Last week in Vermont, the Sanders Institute hosted a sort of a big progressive confab, and there was a lot of focus on Medicare for all, on environment, labor, racial justice, the core defining issues of a leftward agenda. But there was also an international component to it. Fernando Haddad, who, of course, leader for the Workers' Party, was there in from Brazil. Yanis Varoufakis, the celebrity former Greek finance minister, and they announced this idea of a progressive international, which is really just the idea of having much more kind of communication and coordination between left movements and politicians and potentially governments, like we have at least one down with the inauguration of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico. I just want to get your kind of basic take on that move and what the agenda looks like as far as reforming international, particularly their focus is on reforming international financial institutions, democratizing the EU, and things like that. So let me just start with your kind of broad take on that initiative.
I think it's great, and I think it's finally a breath of fresh air after the post-Cold War era of essentially a dedication to U.S. primacy. It's really heartening to see a mainstream American politician come out on behalf of actually organizing and developing ideas with people who are not based primarily in the United States or amongst the United States' traditional allies. So the questions that remain, I think, are really what does this mean in actual practice? Should, for example, Bernie win the presidency? What would it mean? And particularly, what does it mean in terms of using the state apparatus for transnational solidarity building, or whether this is more something that would occur at a sub-state transnational level of organization? And going forward, I just think that highlights the importance of the left distinguishing between what might be considered the foreign policy of the state using state apparatuses like the military, the State Department, et cetera, and the foreign policy of civil society using the grassroots organizations that really transcend national boundaries, and how a political leader like Bernie could work between those. But otherwise, it's a fantastic first step towards making a better world than the world that we'd like to actually live in.
We're going to go basically kind of region by region and continent by continent. But before we get there, I mean, speaking directly to your point, you have actually said you have a critique of left-wing foreign policy thinking that we grew up with and sort of predominated since the, people, of course, rightfully dissenting about what I would deem to be, frankly, essentially American genocide in Vietnam and in Laos and Cambodia. Right. But you have a critique of what has defined the left foreign policy tradition of the past since Vietnam. What's that critique, and what's the alternative you're proposing?
Sure. So I think the critique is essentially not actually on the substance of a lot of the criticisms of American imperialism and the awful American actions in Vietnam and of course, elsewhere throughout the world, as you just discussed a couple of days ago with what George H.W. Bush did as head of the CIA and in Nicaragua with regards to Contras and pardoning everyone. So there's a lot of horror to go around, and I think that the critiques of that were very good. My problem is only that the generation of leftists that were politicized during and after the Vietnam War oftentimes have had more of a critiquing function than an actual any actual pretensions to governance. So looking back, of course, hindsight's 2020, but looking back, I think it would have been useful for what might call the Chomsky generation to have developed counter institutions of American foreign policy that would have developed plans and ideas and really almost ideologies for what the United States could do to actually make the world less organized around America. American hegemony and to make the world a more just place. I think for a variety of reasons, particularly Watergate and the Watergate scandals, led many leftists, understandably, again, to be very skeptical of using state power for any positive ends, and particularly the horrors of the Soviet Union as it continued to wind down also made people skeptical of state power. And therefore, many leftists just disassociated themselves from governance. And but I think what we see now in 2018 is that this actually isn't the most effective way to enact the policies and create the world that you want to see. So what we need to do is develop mechanisms in which people who are ensconced in institutions, what might be left-wing institutions, are actually connected to the grassroots as well. So we're able to have this recirculation process where elites are able to channel grassroots ideas and desires into policy programs that are able to be implemented at the state level.
And I think it's really interesting because you're actually creating, I think in my mind, it's kind of a hybrid, because you're critiquing the sort of exiting of the potential of harnessing those institutions for a radically different way of doing global policy, and one that, you know, centers civil society, one that's built around sharing, you know, solving collective problems of the environmental crisis, global inequality, you know, rampant corporate abuse and power, the tradition, and well as breaking up U.S. hegemony and foreign policy, the traditional concerns of anybody with a conscience on the left. And so you're saying, like, we could use and take over these state institutions to harness and empower civil society in those networks. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, those networks were built in things like solidarity with Latin America in the 80s against Reagan's support of death squads and dictatorships. It was built in, you know, the way the ANC had a global strategy to harness civil society, particularly in Europe and the United States, to apply sanctions to the South African regime. So there's some of what you're talking about and building on already exists, but you're saying, what if the positionality wasn't just always on the outside?
Yes, I that's exactly right. And I do also want to emphasize that this is just the short term goal. The medium term goal would be to really reform these institutions fundamentally, right, to make them substantially more democratic, like the National Security Council, the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the military are all really fundamental institutions. And it's more about recognizing, you know, in the classic Marxian sense, what moment in history you're actually living in, and your history, and actually living, you're actually living into your advantage. And this is not, I'm not saying that these are great institutions by any means. In an ideal world, I think they would probably mostly be taken down, at maximally, and at the very least, I mean, significantly reformed so that they would be unrecognizable. But it's just the question of what do we do, you know, today? The way that I phrase it is, how do we stop a drone strike tomorrow? That's a different question and requires a different answer than how do we totally reform the national security state. And I think both are worthy goals. And just we as lefties need to really have different time horizons and change our strategies accordingly to those different horizons.
100%. So let's start going region by region. Let's focus first here with U.S. policy towards its neighbors, primarily the Caribbean and Latin America. But we could also tack on the trade issue by including, you know, Canada and this these supposed renegotiations of NAFTA that we saw. So I'll break it into two parts. One part is, you know, today there's obviously a resurgent far right taking power across most of Latin America, with the obvious major exception of Mexico and a couple of people hanging on in Bolivia and Uruguay. But Argentina, Chile, and now, of course, with Bolsonaro coming in Brazil, there's this extreme far-right axis. And then, obviously, Venezuela is not in that far-right axis either, although I wouldn't at this point exactly call it. I mean, we need to defend Venezuela from U.S. intervention, but I would not exactly call it really a member of the left in some ways right now. But that might be another conversation. And John Bolton is embracing these governments. There is a very serious danger of, as an example, U.S. military intervention or coup in Venezuela. And there's also, you know, the sort of reorientation back towards another kind of mass unmitigated, you know, U.S. corporate plunder of its neighbors. So actually, let's get to NAFTA second. What's the step right now? from this, you know, left foreign policy perspective of reorienting the Caribbean and Latin America?
Sure. Well, I think as probably many of the listeners will know, I think a lot of the problems in the U.S. and Latin American relationship just stem from the fact of colonialism, 500-year-old colonialism, in which nations of the North Atlantic and what's commonly considered the West just rapaciously, essentially demolished these societies through a variety of measures and means. So first of all, it's not just important to recognize that history as a moral issue, which is important in some sense, but also to recognize it as sort of the deep historical structures that we're dealing with. So this is a region of the world that the United States has increasingly and forever really it perverted in a variety of ways. So the question that I see it is, how does one develop a non-hierarchical relationship where these the Caribbean and Latin America is not just essentially used for U.S. purposes, both economic purposes and sort of the extraction of resources, and also political purposes, as it was during the Cold War and the War on Terror, when the United States variously supported right-wing regimes and demonized the left. So the question is, what is a left-wing in power, left-wing movement in power do with that reality? So I think the fundamental thing that you have to do is reorganize the hierarchical material economic relationships that exist between the regions, develop some means of not rapaciously extracting resources. And this would, I think, have a lot of problems. Like many of our foreign policy problems, also has a lot to do with a changing domestic culture at home. So I think if we have a consumer capitalism centered on the individualist consumer, it's going to be very difficult to rearrange these hierarchical relationships. So what we have to do is really reconceive about how Americans view the very act of consumption from which they have for which they have taken so much from Latin America. So that would really be a first step. I think a second step would be doing things like building solidarities, or at least being vocally against something like the imprisonment of Lula, which I know you've talked a lot about, and that to be very vocal that the United States is not going to allow the imprisonment or not going to allow. See, this is difficult because then you get into these imperial relationships,
right.
But at least allow
is
not the right term,
right.
But that the United States will come out publicly and strongly against actions like that. And that really, I think what's important here is that, like you said, you don't want the American state to really do things, but you do want leftist movements within the United States to build transnational solidarity. So I think in this instance, you'd really want to obviously renegotiate trade deals and things along those lines to make them less awful for Latin America, but also to focus at the sub-state level about working with leftists on the ground in places like Brazil, who really know the territory and terrain, and helping them with the privileged position that Americans find themselves in, and that American leftists find themselves in, just by virtue of living in the metropole of the empire. And so using the resources we have on a grassroots level in Latin America, and really at a sub-state level, because you don't want, in my opinion, at least the American state, to get deeply involved in the region, because in the future, when there's a right-wing president, that will allow for a lot of the very awful things to happen. So you also need to be aware of the limits of the state to do what it wants in this particular area of the world.
What about the NAFTA question specifically?
Well, I basically... because this also relates to the whole Angela Nagel controversy about open borders, right? And I think it's a really difficult question, because you don't want to limit the American leftist imagination due to some basically capitulating to the borders created by capital. So how do you adopt a dual-pronged program where you, on one hand, help American workers and then don't turn your back, which I think we absolutely shouldn't do on the migrants who are often migrating here, because the United States has totally destabilized their region of the world for literally centuries and continues to do so. So I think that's the sort of policy that you want to focus on, a have your cake and eat it too policy, because I think in the world in which we live in, there are, in fact, enough resources to politically distribute to both American workers and the refugees who are coming here for just and important reasons. And I'm personally more of an open borders person than we should to come to the United States to come. So I think you'd want to renegotiate.
Daniel, NAFTA. I'm sorry. You cut out for a second. Can you restate that? Because I think that's really interesting. You are sort of a proponent, as I would be, in sort of like almost like a social EU model in Latin America, the Caribbean, Canada, and the United States, which would mean, along with all of these other dynamics we're addressing with labor, the environment, and breaking down the hierarchy, a much more sort of open borders-oriented kind of transnational stance, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the way that's my biggest long-term foreign policy goals is creating like a true EU but democratic organization, at least in North America, if not including Central and South America. And the question for us is, how do we do that without reimposing US hierarchy on it, right? Where it's not like the dollar is the reserve currency and then everything has to be pegged to what the United States does. And I think that's a really important question that our generation of leftists could examine going forward.
Definitely. All right. So then we're going to keep going here. Europe.
Yeah. And so this is really an interesting one, because this is the one that all the people who promote the liberal international order always point to. And I think it's important for leftists to understand that the end of a great power war in Europe is probably the greatest accomplishment of the order that the world order that the United States set up after 1945.
Definitely.
So I think the question we have to ask is, how do we as leftists, both should we again win power and just at a sub-state level help contribute to the ending of a great power war in Europe? And I think what's important to do is to recognize that first, this is probably unlikely given the culture that's developed over the last 70 years, but we also need to think about ways in which leftists both in and out of state could encourage the democratization of the EU, both in terms of its politics and also in terms of its economics. I think what the European Union has demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt is that an anti-democratic political structure will never receive this type of mass public support it needs to survive. So I think that's the big lesson of the EU since the early 1990s. So the question is, how do we reform that institution to make it more democratic? How do we encourage the acceptance of even more refugees than Europe has currently accepted now? And of course, the United States could be much better about that. And how do we ensure that great power war doesn't continue into the future? So what's happening now is France and Germany are trying to sort of create a central European power bloc to balance against the United Kingdom on one side and Russia on the other. So what does the United States do, right? And particularly, what does the United States do with regards to NATO? I tend to think, and you may very well disagree, reasonable people could disagree, that the United States probably no longer continue to have a serious military presence in Europe and should basically stop funding NATO and leave it up to the local people there to decide, while all the same trying to encourage Europe through a variety of diplomatic measures to make the EU more democratic and to accept more refugees.
Yeah, and this is actually where, as an example, like, you know, things that I wouldn't normally be particularly excited about, but I also, again, we are in our specific historical moment. I think there is, I think there should be a real radical transformation, winding down of what NATO is. But then on the other hand, that actually makes certain things, like when a guy like Macron, who I really could not have more contempt for, talks about like a common European defense policy, that's the type of actually intermediary step that's going to be necessary to unwind these sort of larger imperial alliances you're talking about. So that actually is important there, in my opinion.
Right. I think I agree completely. And so the way is, how do you do this sort of technical thing in the short term without losing sight of the medium and long term goals, which is really, you know, dismantle borders, dismantle the military, and
right,
things along those lines. And just to put a final button on it, the United States should obviously not encroach on Russia's territory, basically sovereign territory of interest. And then there's larger questions about what you do with a country like Ukraine, but that might be for another discussion.
Okay, we'll table some of the Russia. Maybe we'll have a specific Russia East European conversation soon, because I do think that that does sort of create a whole other set of interesting challenges and that play into all these other dynamics. But let's go to the Middle East, and let's include in it, even though obviously they're not relegated to the Middle East, these are highly used in certainly in South Asia and also in a place like Somalia. But let's include the sort of like drone global warfare component in this sort of broader umbrella, because, as you know, I mean, Middle East policy has been reduced to, in addition to obviously supporting vicious monarchies, dictatorships, and so on, also this very kind of one-dimensional note of terrorism, which has had major global consequences in sort of organized modern U.S. foreign policy.
That's absolutely right. So step one is to end the drone war today. I think it has absolutely no strategic purpose and just serves to inflict violence on people who are already oppressed. Step two is to totally invest in alternative energy at home. And I think you're never going to have a just American policy in the Middle East unless the United States actually seriously works to get off fossil fuels. And of course, it's not like a lot of this oil is necessarily flowing to the United States, but it's flowing to America's allies. And there's this vision that the United States essentially needs to extract oil from the Persian Gulf and the various regions. So that's what I think really keeps us there. So I think the first step to really changing America's policy towards Saudi Arabia is to, you know, for example, fill New Mexico with solar panels or something, or on all the government-owned land. So that would be a first step, really reform energy policy. And once you do that, then a lot of your opportunities and of your imagination really opens up. So you could totally reform the Saudi Arabian relationship, really essentially end it, stop providing the Saudi military with and also, of course, the Israeli government with millions of dollars in arms. I think you would stop supporting a Likud Israeli government that totally expands, that constantly abuses Gaza to really a terrible, an almost an unimaginable degree what the Israeli government does with regards to Gaza and the Gaza blockade. So use America's enormous overweening influence on Israeli politics to really change Israeli policy with regard Gaza and also with regard the West Bank. Develop some sort of reparations policy at the very least for those Palestinians who were expelled during the Nakba and all of those really terrible crimes that the United States didn't stop, or at least in some sense implicitly supported. And then the question is what you do with Iran. I think people don't quite appreciate how actually destructive sanctions are. Yeah. They're sort of used as a soft tool, but they actually truly destroy lives and destroy the lives of ordinary people upon whom you'd theoretically want to build a more progressive future. So really you also need to stop sanctions in a serious way and really reformulate how the United States deals with countries that are essentially a liberal or following a different way of life. And I think that involves a total, complete transformation of how the United States understands Islam and Islam's role in foreign societies and Islam's role in the world. And I think leftists are also going to have to really consider what values they want to promote and what the role of the United States is in promoting liberal values that we here take for granted, but that might have particular valences in societies that the United States has long been imbricated in. So it raises a lot of really interesting questions about transnational solidarities that will essentially need to be worked out, in my opinion, in practice.
Yeah, I want to briefly follow up on that before we get to Asia, because I think it raises a really interesting point, particularly the themes around Islam, solidarity, rights, liberalism, illiberalism, but also just a much broader sense of sort of the different foundations upon which people want to build their politics and their societies. And at least for me, I think actually people like Amartya Sen are really helpful for this, because, you know, who's a very prominent Indian economist and philosopher. I think he's at Harvard now. And his sort of argument going back to the 90s in – specifically, he was actually answering autocrats in Singapore and Malaysia who were putting across this thing called Asian values, which in contrast to the sort of anti-Muslim bias of American and European elites, they were kind of drawn to some of these Asian values debates because Asian values ideas, because places like Singapore and Malaysia were certainly posted, you know, incredible gains and accomplishments in terms of market development, but also were very, very socially repressive. Like the idea of, getting caned in Singapore for spitting on the street is actually like not an urban myth. Like that actually has happened.
Right.
And so These guys said, look, we have a different way of organizing our society. We're building it on Confucian values and so on and so forth. And basically to just make it really simple, I mean, Sen's intervention was, look, the Western idea that the only place in the world that came up with an idea of individual, of a sense of individual rights, group well-being, and power accountability, being just specifically from the Western Enlightenment tradition, is false. And you can actually trace ideas of holding power accountable and expanding or certainly the intellectual roots that you could build democratic models on, literally exist in every single social and intellectual tradition on the planet. And what you might find, and so, and also these Asian values guys are wrong too, because they're distorting Confucianism to justify their own autocratic tendencies. And so the answer is you got to sort of build these global sort of, you know, these cross-border recognition where you're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and being a total relativist, like, oh yeah, Saudi Arabia can have gender apartheid because, you know, that's how they do Islam and we're super open-minded. That's wrong and we oppose it. But then conversely, maybe we also recognize that somebody wants to build a rights-oriented, flourishing society that also, you know, they might be rooted in different, you know, Islamic traditions, as an example. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
No, that makes total sense. And I think you see a lot of these discussions come up and a lot of these issues come up in debates over the veil, right, which was such a hot topic about 20 years ago, because from what was then the American, or really the French lens at the time, it was viewed as an oppressive piece of clothing. But when you actually see how it historically operated, you know, for example, in Cairo at various moments, in Baltimore at various moments, it's actually a symbol of women asserting their space in the public sphere. Right. So it's actually a symbol of liberation when it was totally interpreted here by many people, by many liberals and those on the right, as a symbol of oppression. Right. So we also need to be very important not to impose our own frameworks onto these other spaces in which the United States empire is involved. And I think it just highlights the importance of that. There is no one solution to any of those issues about cultural differences and cultural relativism, that you really have to get on the ground and have a deep knowledge of the area. And really, always the sine qua non of this is always listen to the local peoples. You know, if you're a member of an American NGO that happens to have a lot of resources, you should never ever, or left wing NGO or whatever it may be, a good organization. There's a lot of problems with NGOs. We can get to that in a different case. But let's say you're a good person trying to do good things. What you really need to do is listen to people on the ground and really build networks of solidarity across borders, where you're not just imposing your own view. And it's a very difficult thing to do, because we're all are prisoners of our own identities. Right. But it's something that I think we need to really work toward, as long as the United States has all this overwhelming power. Right. I think we can't retreat from these questions, because this is the pure material fact that so much capital is centered here, and the military, the world's military, is really the United States' military. So we have to think about these questions, even if we prefer, you know, to leave them aside, because they're really quite difficult and oftentimes won't have a good answer.
100%. All right. Asia, which I know that's huge, but I mean, I don't know. So what do we, I mean, obviously there's the North Korea dimension, there's China, the reemergence of sort of power politics, you know, TPP, right, India, whatever way you want to take it. But what's the progressive orientation towards Asia?
I think this is really important, because I think this will be a big division between progressives like myself and realists like Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer. Right. So realists like who otherwise you leftists should build coalitions with, particularly with regards to U.S. policy in Europe and the Middle East, where there's actually a lot of agreements. But the biggest disagreement between people like me and Walt and Mersheimer is that Walt and Mersheimer think that the rise of China as a serious great power competitor necessitates the United States to maintain some sort of serious presence in East Asia and the South China Sea. So I would disagree with that, because I think that assumption is based on the idea that the United States should never face any peer competitor, and that that some sort of primacy and unipolarity is actually really necessary to maintain world peace. And I think this is a very mid-20th century idea, understandably emerging from World War II. But in some sense, in my opinion, the rise of another great power could actually be good for world peace and good for stability. One, because it'll actually allow the United States to exit from the region and have some sort of ideally peaceful security transition to where China essentially assumes responsibility for a lot of the security concerns of the region, and which will bring a lot of capital home and will also prevent the American perversion of an area of the world in which it hasn't been involved particularly long and about which it doesn't know very much. Now, the problem, though, is that China is certainly authoritarian, and it's not only authoritarian, but it's authoritarian capitalist. So this also creates, again, difficult questions about what do you do as a leftist who has a particular value position on the world, when you're essentially ceding an enormous part of the world to an authoritarian capitalist power. And of course, I should underline the United States has done, an enormous amount of damage to the region. So I'm not saying that the U.S. would be better or has been better, but I'm just saying these are difficult ethical questions for a leftist to actually pursue, right? Do you want, for example, Chinese authoritarianism to now govern the entire Eastern Hemisphere of the world? I mean, right. Ideally, no, because that limits freedom and limits liberation in really important ways that I think leftists should be concerned with. But then again, there's also the reality of that the United States shouldn't and doesn't have the political will to maintain permanent presence in a region that's so far from its shores. So I think the first step to do is get beyond this idea that a great power competitor is always necessarily negative for the United States. But then we really have to think through what we as leftists do to help combat the authoritarian impulses of the Chinese Communist Party. And it's not an easy question. Now, I think some of these things will be regionally worked out on their own, particularly the Sino-Indian conflict, which is kind of always at a low ebb. But I think with the rise of Modi, it's getting even more powerful, you know, another member of this authoritarian axis that Bernie had pointed out in a recent speech. So I think in some sense, it's up to the peoples of this part of the world to work out their own history for them without the perversions of the United States. But we in the United States could also take some sort of at least sort of ethical position about what is the proper way to resist authoritarianism or to transform it in a democratic and liberatory direction.
Yeah, and
without military aid.
Without military aid, but and included in that right. already, you know, issues that I don't want to, you know, that of course, I mean, I understand why people I think there's like three steps, right? There's the sort of recognition that human rights are a proxy and have absolutely, including, you know, literally like a proxy for U.S. militarism and invasions, and also, but even in a more soft variety, a proxy to formalize a Western dominated order. Okay, that's a very valuable and correct critique. And there's a certain intelligence and corrective in, you know, don't get your own house in order. You know, particularly, I mean, if right. you're in the United States, focus on what you're doing in Yemen or, you know, and so on, 100%. But I think the third step is there is this, if you really have this left perspective, there is a real concept of global solidarity. And so therefore, like the Uyghur population can't be eliminated in that. The occupation of Tibet, you know, one can have whatever view they want to have of, you know, Tibetan society. And I would recognize, you know, sure, there's some romanticism. I think there's also, that's another area where there's been an overcorrected critique of that society as well. All of that being as it may, it's occupied and it's being, you know, culturally cleansed and environmentally destroyed. You know, these are real issues of anybody who is concerned about these issues wherever they may take place.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And particularly what's going on now with the Uyghurs, from my limited layman's understanding, yeah. there seems to be a lot of, they're being organized in concentration camps. Yeah. And the left shouldn't shrink from criticizing that. And I don't think the left does shrink from criticizing that, to be frank. But the question is, then what do you do when you don't want the American military to do anything, essentially, and you don't want sanctions, which will destroy the lives of ordinary people? So I think you could essentially adopt, on one hand, the ethical position that living in the imperial metropole, that you do have more voice than many of the voiceless who are affected by these policies. And then on the other hand, I think, like you said, build true global solidarities, whether they be working class solidarities, whether they be cultural solidarities or whatever it may be, build these sorts of solidarities so that at least you can give aid and assistance to those living within these societies who want to transform it in ideally a peaceful way, both mostly because I think any other non-peaceful way will be immediately crushed by the awesome power of the Chinese military.
Let's go to Africa, where now, I mean, it does continue on a China theme, because one way of understanding Africa that a guy like a brilliant analyst like Milton Alamadi would say is that, you know, there's actually basically just another version of a sort of multi-party colonial game there, primarily between the United States and China, but certainly also France, with a huge amount of sort of residual power and influence there and colonial relationships. I mean, you know, even a guy like Macron is quite willing to fly there and sort of lecture Africans on their sexual habits, Mr. Right. You know, sort of global woke answer to Trump. And at the same time, Africa also is experiencing its own sort of, you know, boom in some areas because it's an untapped area of the global economy. And you have, you know, governments like the African National Congress in South Africa who have these amazing, incredible, you know, sort of iconic histories struggling with the contradictions of liberation, national liberation, and then being enfolded into this global capitalist order. What's the play in Africa?
That's a really great way of framing the whole issue. And so I think what we need to admit from the first is that a lot of the U.S. policy toward Africa and African relations is really raises more questions and provides fewer answers. Because, again, like Latin America, this is a region that's been so destroyed by hundreds of years of colonial oppression that it's really difficult to take anything from day one. So as I see it, the question is, how do you give people in Africa sovereignty over their own resources while at the same time not give sovereignty, but allow them to maintain sovereignty in a global marketplace and seriously enact their sovereignties without at the same time reinforcing domestic oppressions that exist in many African countries? And I think it's really difficult because the previous answer that many leftists had given is sort of development politics. Mm-hmm. But as many historians have shown, is that development politics are actually extremely problematic. In many ways, they shore up old elites, they shore up traditional hierarchies, and they actually make societies worse with all that capital flowing in. And that's really the way that the United States and China today are really trying to affect African politics. So again, I think it's mostly at this point, I don't have a good answer for what policy should be. I think we need to rethink how Africa fits into the place of the American imagination as sort of something always down there, something from which they either a place of violence or a place where things are seized from, and really start to build connections with African people on the ground in order to understand what their own goals and visions and dreams are. And without that sort of hard knowledge, it'll be difficult to actually develop an American policy. So how do you make, how do you help, not again, I'm using the language of make, but how do you really help foster African democracy from a grassroots perspective from the United States? Should it be the concern of the American state to do that? Should it be the concern of sub-state transnational organizations to do that? I'm more likely to say that it should be the role of sub-state organizations, but these are really open questions. And I think the first thing to do is actually listen to people in Africa on the ground.
Absolutely. And I would also just add to that, the very clear, especially specifically with the United States. I mean, the United States is an African country. And right. it's in addition, of course, it's a European country. Of course, it's also, I mean, but it is a global country, and it is the seat of American empire. But I would say that very specifically, historically, I mean, obviously, first and foremost, it's a country of the Native Americans who were genocided and had their homes stolen, and that is the foundation of this country, of course. And then it is a European project for both great evil and also revolutionary good in some respects. It's a tradition that can be built mm-hmm. off of. And then it's also through the other, you know, the other founding historical crime and sin of this country, obviously slavery, it is a African country. So that not only, right, should it not be relegated, there is this direct foundational relationship built obviously on mass murder, theft, exploitation, and abuse. But people came here from Africa in the worst of conditions and helped not only literally, physically build this country through, you know, slave labor, but also the entire political, intellectual, artistic infrastructure of this country is a essentially African as much as it is European. And I know this will trigger a lot of people, but facts don't care about your feelings.
That's a great point. Absolutely true. I mean, African history is central to American history, as European history is central to American history. And I think there is a deep relationship between these two world regions, a deep and complicated and often rapacious on behalf of the United States' relationship that really raises a lot of really difficult questions centered on development, security, and what the United States could do as having, I think, at least literally a moral responsibility to to help the people of the continent who have been so destroyed by Western and American colonialism over the past 120 years. And it's really difficult. And I think one thing that we could do, at least in places like the Majority Report and the Michael Brooks Show, is at least raise awareness, because I think most Americans have no sense of what's going on in Africa. So I think at least raise awareness about what the left could possibly do to help people on the ground.
You cut out a bit, but I do have a final question for you, Daniel. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, so this is great, and obviously there's a lot of other theme. I mean, there's plenty more content we're going to do. But the final question I have, one of the things emerging out of this as a complement to the idea of that Ocasio-Cortez is doing so much great work with entering into Congress of a Green No Deal in America to green the economy, create a bunch of new jobs. There's some interesting arguments about that already coming out of the gate on would the sort of level of consumption that came out of that sort of still pose long-term problems in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and so on. But being that as it may, I mean, do you think that there's now the talk of a global Green New Deal? Do you think that dealing with the ecology crisis and all of its manifestations, because let's not just climate, but also deforestation, acidification of oceans, and all of the just primary human concerns that are implicated in that. Do you think that that's a solid sort of organizing principle to build this nexus around of a global leftward governance and movements?
That's a great question. I think ethically and morally, yes. And I actually think also that it will be something around which we'll be able to build solidarity, particularly generationally. And so I think there's a big difference between people who are, let's say, older than 65 and people who are younger than 65 due to a variety of historical experiences, but also because the people over 65 are not really going to be personally dealing with the after effects of climate change. Ideally, what will happen is we'll see in the next 20, 30 years as leadership cadres begin to be replaced by younger generational cohorts, greater recognition of the damage wrought by climate. Now, of course, this really remains an open question. And I think the first thing you said about consumer capitalism is actually really critical. So a good way to think about capitalism is like who's considered the heroic subject, right? At some point, it used to be the capitalist, and then on some level it used to be the laborer. But now I think it's really fair to say in the North Atlantic, and particularly in the United States, it's the consumer. So we have to really point to this as one of the problems of not only capitalism, which has a ton of problems identified by Marx, but also consumer capitalism specifically, which is placing consumption at the center of economic exchange and economic activity. So I think that's really a really important place that we can start now, because I don't think, honestly, and somewhat tragically, we're going to get much movement on climate for at least the next 5 years. But what we could do as leftists is start really questioning the very model of consumer capitalism, and that maybe it's not the most important thing to be able to get a prime package in 2 days, but rather to have it so that people are able to work humane hours. And that maybe we shouldn't always think about just consuming more and more, but the ways in which other values need to overcome consumption as the center. Now, I'm not saying that we should sort of fetishize or heroize austerity, not at all. But I'm just saying that there might be tensions between rampant consumption and the ability to do good in the world that we need to explore and theorize more fully, or I think a lot of people have done this, but discuss more explicitly in forums like this one.
Daniel Bessner, this is great. I really appreciate your time as always. And just once again, everybody, the book is Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectuals. Really important book for understanding our world today. Daniel Bessner, thanks a million as always. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Michael. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. All right, folks. I think we've got our marching orders.
That about covers it.
That with like the major exception of things like, are we going to have another like arms race with Russia? It does cover it. But covered a good amount. I'm going to just do a brief editorial here. I mean, Bernie, if you start to think properly globally, which you have to, not in the sense of like, oh, I'm someone who's informed about what's, you know, the crisis in Indonesia, you know, so you can sort of like look smart at a dinner party. But just the fact that whether you're talking ecologically, whether you're talking the ability to establish the type of great goals that, as an example, Jeremy Corbyn has in the UK, you are always going to be under danger. I mean, my God, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. Amount of pushback he's going to get from the United States, from Anglo capital, from traditional power hierarchies and corruption inside Mexican politics is going to be awe-inspiring if he actually attempts to do the agenda that he outlined in his inaugural speech, which was totally clear and uncompromising about the rampant theft of neoliberalism and also his solutions, which really are basically, you know, Rooseveltian social democracy, but that's considered to be incredibly radical for people in a developing country and anywhere in our modern context. And of course, would be a huge improvement for most people's lives in Mexico. So you got to think in those terms, because even if you're just primarily concerned with the United States, both there's the ethical obligation from what we project through empire and also the reality that it's going to be profoundly hard to sustain progressive domestic accomplishments in a world governed by capital. And so you need to be thinking in those terms. And Bernie Sanders is the only one. I'll always give credit. Chris Murphy's great in terms of his focus on the rampant crimes and abuses that the United States is supporting and participating in every day in Yemen. Most Democrats have renewed their support for the Iran deal, which is the great accomplishment of the Obama administration. And most have talked about, you know, various concerns of global ecology and this and that. And that's great. But the only one with a diagnosis of the world, let alone global solidarity, is Bernie Sanders, period. And I hope that changes. But you got to be real about that. Okay, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Pennies a day makes this show possible and us accountable to you, first and foremost. The Bell House show for the Majority Report is almost sold out. Get your tickets quickly.
Those tickets are in the double digits, folks.
Yeah, quickly, quickly,
remaining?
Quickly.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Like this might be your last day,
yeah,
folks.
This is probably the last day to do it. I'd go do that immediately. There's a link on the majority.fm homepage. The Michael Brooks show also at a very steady clip, so that if you hold off and wait till the last couple of weeks they're open, it's looking like it will be the same situation. So I would just go get those tickets quickly as well for the February 1st Michael Brooks show. Michael Brooks show on Patreon, patreon.com/TMBS. Just did an illicit history of neoliberalism with Quinn Slobodian. Mike Racine was a huge amount of fun. Next Tuesday, Matt Taibbi's back. You can also really start to really regularly watch clips. We've been really ramping up Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, and there's the Unlock Post Game with Richard Wolf. You could, of course, subscribe to it on iTunes. YouTube is suppressing our free speech and has not monetized our videos yet for a variety of just...
For whatever reason, I think it might be the size of the Majority Report clip. We don't run into nearly as much copyright issues as we are running into with the Michael Brooks
show.
Yeah,
I wonder if it does. I'm being facetious when I say the free speech stuff to make fun of Dave Rubin, but it is actually really weird.
I think it's just algorithmic. Like, MR is bringing in money
already,
so they're not going to F with us. But we got dinged for playing a Trump clip from the Associated Press the other day, which by any reasonable standard would obviously be fair use. Otherwise, what purpose is the Associated Press
literally, what purpose is the
serving?
AP? Exactly. And so now there is an ad on that video. Because it's gotten a lot of views,
but
and
we
the
don't
money
wanna,
is going to the AP.
Yeah, and we don't want to change exactly how we're doing the show. So ultimately, if we have to choose between playing clips like that are going to give context or completely, you know, expunging that sort of stuff and having a completely like media-less show, we're going to do the former, and we're probably going to run into copyright issues. So that's why things like Patreon are a nice, useful end-around around that sort of thing.
Exactly. So yeah, that's the situation. Matt, what's going on with Literary Hangover, and happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Yeah, tomorrow night, recording on Democracy and Change. I've been getting deep into that controversy. It's be very interesting. Basically, to give you a little preview, it's sort of the question is James Buchanan libertarian's Machiavelli or libertarianism's Forrest Gump?
That's a good frame. Check out The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada, the Wu-Tang universe of left-wing podcasts. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Does this.